We all have idiosyncrasies that can annoy, even repel people at home or in the workplace. At a pronounced level, these personal characteristics can be defined clinically as a borderline personality disorder. I'm Bill Anderson. Today on Central Standard, destructive behaviors that make relationships difficult, maybe even impossible. We'll talk about narcissism, selfish, delusional, combative behavior. And does social media contribute to a more narcissistic society? We'll explore that. And we talk about ways in which you can cope or at least deal with a narcissist at home or work. All this, plus your phone calls, email, and yes, social media questions and comments. First, the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Authorities in Yemen say their security forces have foiled a plot by al-Qaeda operatives to infiltrate oil and gas export facilities in the country. The BBC's Frank Gardner says these reports come as Western governments have drawn down their diplomatic staffs in Yemen.
There are two perceived plots or threats here. One is against Western interests, particularly the Americans, and that's what's caused them to shut their embassy not only in Yemen, but around the entire wider Middle East. The second one, details of which have only really emerged in the last 24 hours, is what the Yemenis are saying, the Yemeni authorities are saying, is a plot by al-Qaeda to seize or attack installations and government places inside Yemen. So in other words, there are two strands to this plot, and it's not clear how they are related. But we've been hearing details that dozens of al-Qaeda militants have allegedly, according to the Yemeni authorities, been moving from the provinces into the capital in preparation to try and take part in these attacks.
The BBC's Frank Gardner reporting there. The office of Egypt's interim president says diplomatic efforts to resolve that country's political crisis over the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi are ending, adding that the efforts have failed. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson reports from Cairo that the Egyptian presidency blames the Muslim Brotherhood for the failure.
The official statement accuses the Brotherhood of refusing to stop the, quote, bloodshed, which it says is what kept diplomacy from succeeding. The president's office says the interim government fully cooperated over the past 10 days with diplomats who came here from the United States, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East to try and end the crisis. It says it welcomes future efforts by those parties to help promote a democratic transition. The statement does not say what the Egyptian government's next step will be. Authorities have warned that they intend to break up two major sit-ins in the outskirts of Cairo by Morsi's supporters. That would likely lead to more violence. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
The human rights group Amnesty International reports its latest satellite surveillance over Aleppo, Syria, shows the deep impact of the Syrian civil war.
Widespread destruction of both what appears to be civilian infrastructure, housing, as well as public facilities.
Amnesty spokesman Scott Edwards says the Syrian civil war has uprooted 6 million people and 4 million are inside Syria, many with no access to humanitarian aid. Stormy weather in the upper Midwest has been causing some problems.
A lot of trees were knocked down in Minnesota, Wisconsin. There were power lines down. There were even some roofs blown off. Quite a bit of damage with hail.
That's forecaster Chris Broyles, who says the worst damage was in Iowa. This is NPR News. Mortgage applications are up. NPR's Janine Herbst reports that's happening even though mortgage interest rates are also going up.
The Mortgage Bankers Association Index of Mortgage Applications shows requests for loans on new houses up 0.7% last week, and the index for overall applications, both refinancing and new loans, up 0.2%. That's despite the fact that interest rates have been on the rise, up 1% since May, after the Federal Reserve indicated it may slow down its economic stimulus package. Still, loan rates are at historic lows. The average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was 4.61% last week. Janine Herbst, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama has been promoting his plan to overhaul the housing finance system. He wants to phase out the big government-backed mortgage financiers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and make private lenders thereby more responsible for the risks they take. A bipartisan proposal in the Senate is similar. Republicans in the House have some objections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says obesity rates are dropping among low-income preschoolers in 19 states and U.S. territories. The 1 percentage point drop in many locations may appear small, but CDC officials say it is significant if it turns out that the efforts to curb child obesity are starting to work. Nearly a third of U.S. children are classified as overweight. U.S. and Japanese officials are meeting in Tokyo for talks on various issues related to a U.S.-led effort to create a Trans-Pacific Partnership regional trade bloc. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com.
If I were to ask you if you know a narcissist, I suspect you would rattle off two or three names without even thinking twice. But are they? Narcissism is a word thrown around a lot to describe people we perceive as selfish, vain, and driven by an ego the size of the Capitol building in Washington. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Today, we not only look at narcissistic behavior, but we get a better understanding of what it means. And how might we better interact with said people at work, at play, at home? And how can we better understand what we see playing out on the national level in politics, entertainment, and sport? With us this morning, Dr. Bruce Lease. Bruce is a professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. Good to have you.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
How's your summer going?
Too fast.
Yeah, you're an avid boater, so I have to ask you, have you had any opportunities to get on the water?
No, I have to admit it's just been too busy this summer.
Ah, that's not good.
No, but
well, Bruce, you know, let's get started here and let me ask you this. Are we a little loose with our use of the word narcissist? And is there anything wrong in using that word loosely?
I think that it's just human nature to use labels for people, and I don't think there will ever be an end to people labeling each other. And, you know, sometimes using a term loosely like narcissist is helpful and useful, and it conveys what is. And, you know, if somebody is told directly, you're acting really narcissistic, it might provide just the right message versus you seem all about yourself. So
yeah, you know, I see your point there, but what I'm thinking, we're so quick to run to the internet and diagnose other people's problems, and I just wonder if there's not an inherent risk in that, and if that can damage relationships or even damage the other person's ego or self-esteem.
Well, a discussion about the overuse of the internet would probably take us a month, and I think that concept could apply, the overuse of the internet, to probably just about every single phenomenon.
So. Yeah, fair enough. So why don't you give us your working definition of narcissism?
Well, I would love to take credit for the working definition, but I think it better even to mention that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, also known as DSM, does that job for all clinicians dealing with people with problems. The DSM-5, the new one that just came out in May, defines narcissists just as it did in the last version, essentially people who have a grandiose sense of their own importance and they exaggerate their achievements, their talents, they have fantasies of unlimited success and power and brilliance and beauty and ideal love, and they think they're special and unique. And so it's a standard definition that I would think that most people have a good sense of. So
yeah.
That's the standard.
Yeah. So you know, some of those things are kind of rooted in good qualities, but maybe a narcissist takes it to the extreme level and subsequently damages relationships with other people?
Yeah, it's interesting because in yesterday's – or 2 days ago, the New York Times talked about controversial research on the different generations, and there were mm-hmm. claims made in this New York Times article by a researcher who said that society is essentially becoming more narcissistic. And You know, it's not absolutely necessarily so. You know, the research is on epidemiology of personality disorders is not real clear, but.
Well, interestingly enough, her name is Dr. Twenge. I saw the same article. She's a researcher and a professor at San Diego State, and she's drawing a lot of criticism from peers. You know, they're saying she's just drawing wide conclusions, broad conclusions from this, what, somewhat flawed, according to others, somewhat flawed research.
Right. And so, you know, some of the assumptions we draw about the prevalence of these personality disorders is not real sound.
Yeah, and she's saying, you know, the millennial generation has been and continues to become more and more narcissistic. Now, I personally refute that just based on my experiences. However, to me, that just seems really dangerous to with just
one fell swoop,
pretty much dismiss an entire generation.
Right, and. You know, that's correlational research using her particular survey instrument. And it does. The reason why I even brought up the research is because one of the you talked about potential good qualities there in a narcissist's way of thinking. One of the criticisms of her work is that she may just be measuring self-esteem. Uh-huh. And self-esteem and narcissism are highly related to each other. If you have good self-esteem, you don't need to be a narcissist. And if you're a narcissist, you probably have bad self-esteem. But in response to your original question about whether there are some good qualities, there are. And the research that has been done by the investigator you mentioned actually may be tapping more self-esteem than narcissism.
Okay.
And that's how that's relevant.
What do you think? Maybe you work with a person who is difficult in the ways we're discussing. Perhaps you are the difficult personality. Phone 816-235-2888. Feel free to phone or send an email to @centralstandard@kcur.org. Okay, Bruce. Let me just ask you this. Will a narcissist behave one way with one group of people and then in a narcissistic way, and then with another peer group, behave completely in a completely normal fashion?
You know, these personality disorders that we're talking about just two of them, and these two personality disorders fall under the more broad category of personality disorders generally. And even though these are pervasive patterns that people have when they're diagnosed with personality disorders, you know, they manifest, they come out more or less depending on their environment and the circumstances. So you asked me if people act differently, narcissists act differently from group to group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other things about being a narcissist besides the narcissism. There's intellect and social intelligence, and then there's, you know, just good interpersonal skills. A highly skilled narcissist, somebody who really succeeds in life as a narcissist, will be able to play whatever crowd he or she is in. A less skilled narcissist will be less skilled. I mentioned the other poor personality disorders because all of the personality disorders tend to create problems in relationships. So navigating relationships is an issue for all people with personality disorders. It's an issue rather than
identify just some of those challenges with relationships.
Well, you might as well start with narcissism. A narcissist has such a great need to prove that he or she is great that a healthy person will spot that in a hurry and be repelled rather than drawn to somebody like mm-hmm. that.
To a delusional level.
Could be. It yeah. depends on how severe the problem is.
Okay.
So I will mention over and over again that the personality disorders that we will talk about today, borderline and narcissism, both are propelled largely by problems with the person's real sense of who they are and how worthwhile they are.
Hmm.
You know, there are at least two healthy ways of thinking about being human. One of them is that we're all fallible and imperfect and flawed, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That That's the main one. So to the extent that you can think that you're fallible and flawed, and that's okay. And along the same lines, the ability to make mistakes and acknowledge the mistakes and grow from them, that's another important phenomenon. And people who have personality disorders tend to not do those things very well. They tend to have problems in those areas.
Okay. And so am I hearing you say it's rooted in just a low self-esteem?
That's a little bit too broad.
Okay.
Somebody with a narcissistic personality at a very deep level doubts their worth, and they're puffing themselves up to be narcissistic is an effort to compensate for that inadequacy. And you asked earlier about the way it affects relationships. If I'm trying to puff myself up because I don't feel very good about myself, ultimately I'm going to have strong reactions when people don't like that very well.
Okay.
So while we're talking about relationships with people with narcissism, many a good clinician has recognized that a person's emotional reaction to another person tells them a lot about the other person. If you feel either really enamored with somebody because you think they're really super great, or you feel intimidated by somebody because you think they're really great, if you have feelings in reaction to somebody, it's probably telling you about that person. Somebody who's really turned off by somebody because they're talking about how great they are may be dealing with a narcissist. Somebody who feels little and small and inadequate may be dealing with a narcissist. Humility is an important coping skill just to get through life and to get along with people. Narcissists lack humility as well as empathy.
Is that do we know if that's biological? Is it based in genetics? Is it environment? What's at play here? How does one grow up to be a narcissist?
Well, a good way to think about what causes these kinds of psychological problems is to think about, you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So to me, a psychologist who doesn't study brain functioning, to me, it's all about learning. Mm. If I were a brain scientist, I would be very, very committed to looking for the chemicals that cause narcissism. And so being a psychologist, I prefer to think in the development of narcissism about early life experiences, encounters with people who are important in one's life, those kinds of things.
Yeah. We had promised that we would help people who have relationships with narcissists. We promised that we would help them deal with some or learn some coping skills. And what's the first thing you would say to me if I tell you I'm having a challenging time with someone? Let's say it's in the workplace.
Well, the most important thing to realize is that you have to be mindful about what's going on in the interaction. If you encounter somebody who is narcissistic and you say or do the wrong thing by their way of thinking, that is, if you challenge their desire to be great and you cause what's known in some circles as a narcissistic wound, you can get in a lot of trouble. So in the workplace or in a social situation where people are stratified, you have to just be really careful about tripping someone's trigger and wounding them narcissistic. If they are narcissistic, wounding them in such a way that they want to retaliate.
Yeah, right.
So the thing to do is to be mindful about the encounter. And when you're feeling attacked or little and small, or you're feeling like you need to compete with them for greatness, step back, think twice, don't say a word until you've really conceptualized what's going on between the two of you.
But here we're dealing with a person who feels entitled, is arrogant, unrealistic, combative.
Yeah, I'll go out on a limb here and say that few people who work in a moderately sized workplace, few people can avoid encountering narcissistic people. Mm. People who feel that it's okay to degrade others, to publicly demean other people or publicly shame people, criticize them. People who do that are possibly, if not probably, narcissistic, probably profoundly insecure and are getting triggered by some threat. So the question here you asked is, what should people do? Back off, think twice before reacting, and realize that you may be dealing with a problem way bigger than what they're saying the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
Being treated well by somebody who's humble should tell you that you're probably in the presence of a very healthy person that you don't have to fear and you don't have to worry about your safety, emotional safety. Being in the presence of somebody who's publicly confrontive or hurtful should cause you to pause and realize that there is danger.
I think the natural inclination is to just avoid the person, and obviously it doesn't matter what kind of a relationship you have with this individual, whether it be at work or at play or in the home. That can't be. There's nothing positive that comes from that.
Right. Safety is of the utmost importance, and people discover that they've married narcissists. They've discovered after being offered a job and realizing that this isn't the best job in the whole world simply because a boss or a coworker is a narcissist. Having a neighbor who's a narcissist that hates the color of your house. I mean, these are all things that create a danger for people around them.
It's Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. Dr. Bruce Leese is in the house. We're talking about narcissism. We'll be talking about borderline personality disorders later in the hour. And we'd invite your phone calls to 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Shoot us a call at your earliest convenience, and we have all our lines open at this moment, so now's a good time to phone in.
You know, as I think about
sounded
people,
like a pledge break there. I apologize.
Well done. As I think about people calling in, to call a radio station and admit that you're working or living with somebody who is a narcissist uh-huh. is a real risky kind of thing.
Yeah, I suppose you're right there.
You know, if you called and said, "I'm Bill," this is Bill in Kansas City, and my boss is a narcissist, I think you might be packing for a new job.
Yeah, let me ask you this: is there a point at which a relationship with a narcissist can potentially become dangerous?
Oh, I've heard all of the stories. one way a relationship with a narcissist is dangerous is that you may trust them with a lot of vulnerability, a lot of personal risks. Mm-hmm. You know, you tell them your deepest, darkest secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And if a narcissist turns on you, it can get ugly. And, you know, the harm might not be to physical safety, but certainly to psychological
sure.
safety. And in the workplace, that's even more pronounced. If somebody works with somebody who's narcissistic, their job is always at risk, even if it's a coworker, because you may be getting pounded by a narcissistic coworker on the same level as you. But if you dare to report them, it may not, it may be very punitive.
Mm-hmm.
If the person is not a protected class, for example, employment-wise, I don't know that there's any real, except a good boss, I don't know if there's any real recourse.
So the risks are psychological, probably not physical.
How about to livelihood? Both, actually, you know. Putting food on the table is what keeps us physically healthy. And if you don't have a job because a narcissist at work turned on you, it's not healthy in any way.
Do we know anything about career paths of narcissists? Is there
a this given is a limb.
I don't know how far out it is. Doctor.
I don't know how far out we should go on this limb, but
yeah.
There's recently.
Well, we don't want to speculate or, you know.
Let's put it this way.
Yeah.
The amount of pain and suffering it takes to get certain kinds of careers, political careers, for example,
mm-hmm.
where one has to be out on the campaign trail for most of one's career. One has to stand up to others who might have similarly strong egos and want to fight. You know, all that requires more than just a healthy ego. Some people would argue that in order to become something like a politician, one would have to be narcissistic to some extent, believe they're superior. I don't necessarily believe that, but we only have 100 senators in the entire country, and what kind of thinking must go into thinking that, you know, I am one of those 100, or even president? Mm-hmm. You know, what it's got to, you have to have a lot of self-esteem and thick skin or be a narcissist. Self-esteem plus thick skin or narcissism would allow you to be in something as hazardous as politics.
The phone number is 816-235-2888. Barbara is calling from Overland Park.
Hi there.
Hi, Barbara.
Well, I have found myself in a challenging situation. My husband and I have just celebrated our 14th wedding anniversary, and he has an aunt who I have never really been particularly close to, been to her house once in the 17 years that we've been together. And she has decided that she's going to move here to Kansas City. She has two children of her own, but that she's going to move here to Kansas City to be a part of our lives. And it seems to me that everything she's exhibited is very narcissistic. We've talked about it at length. And I just don't, I mean, she has made statements about not really being concerned about us including her in our lives, that she will make it happen regardless of the outcome if it causes a problem between the two of us. And I mean, it's been a very bizarre, very difficult, very challenging situation to be in. And she is now here. She moved here last weekend.
Before I hand it over to Bruce, Barbara, so did she consult you about this?
She announced it,
she announced it.
I had a very long, very emotional conversation with her about the fact that we have very full lives, that her moving here alone at the age of 68, I was afraid, and she's just recently gone through a divorce, and that I was afraid that emotionally I didn't know if she would be in a position to handle being alone as much as she was going to be alone here.
Okay.
I mean, I was very forthright and honest with her about it, and she couldn't have been more offended, couldn't have been less affected by this very heartfelt conversation that I had with her.
Bruce?
I want to say something about being a caller before I answer your question. You know, when I do this, especially with Bill here, I almost feel like we could talk for 10 hours without callers. But Barbara, your call reminds me of how valuable the calls are, because you've gotten me to think about four or five things I wouldn't have thought of if it weren't for your call. So for that reason, I greatly appreciate the call. So here are the four or five things. Number one, you said you had an emotional conversation with her. Somebody who is narcissistic, and I will not try to diagnose this aunt, but somebody who's narcissistic will bring out emotions in you, and threat will be a big potential emotion. And so if you had an emotional conversation with her, it's probably because you felt some threat by this action that she proposed, and then the fallout following it. And the most important thing to do when dealing with somebody who you believe is trying to control you, is narcissistic, etc., is to regain control of your own feelings. Don't let yourself feel threatened, and don't allow for any emotional conversations. If you feel emotional, say, I'll need to think about this, I'll call you back, and get out of the conversation before you display emotions, because then it starts to look like it's your problem also, which it isn't yet. It's her problem. Number one, you said this is your husband's whatever, she's an aunt, but if you're in a relationship with somebody and somebody on the outside is involved, like an aunt, or even if you're, one of your kids is becoming narcissistic, or if you have a sibling or parent, make sure that you function as a team, collaborate, talk to each other about specifically, and this would be another point, your boundaries. You know, what's okay and what's not okay. And that can be as specific as, you know, how can she come over whenever she wants, or does she have to call in advance and get permission? Does she get a key to the house or not? So keep the threat rate down and stay completely calm, or stop the conversation till you can. Make sure you collaborate with the people who you're close to who may also be affected. Maintain your boundaries. And I'll take it to another point I wanted to make. when you're defining boundaries, what that means is identify specific behaviors that are okay and not okay. And instead of responding to the whole person, just say, you know, you've asked for a key to our house, and that's something that my husband and I, if you two have talked, have decided we're not going to do. We're not giving out keys to the house. Or we've decided that, you know, we're at the point where we need more privacy than you might imagine, so we want you to call before you come over. So these are all ways to deal with a narcissist or anybody who tries to invade your life insensitively. And the final thing I'll say, and again, I thank you for the call because it gets me thinking about stuff like this, don't take it personally. When somebody else has a personality disorder or a problem that seems to leak out onto everyone who comes close to them, when somebody has that kind of personality, the worst thing you can do is start to take it personally. And that gets back to the first point, which is, and then become emotional. So, Barbara, thank you again. I appreciate the calls because it gets me thinking about real people trying to answer real questions.
You referenced children, and Susan from Lenexa has a question. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Wow, it's so interesting listening to all this because it's really describing our son. He is 26. He college graduate. You know, he's achieved that in his life, but it seems like and we've done therapy when he was younger. He had issues. I think his dad and I always were concerned that he didn't have a conscience, didn't have much empathy for other people. And so we got him counseling. You know, we had some episodes, some situations that, you know, kind of precipitated that. But diagnosed as bipolar, wouldn't take his meds, you know, didn't feel like he needed to. This was when he was in his, you know, adolescent years, you know, middle school, high school. Well, he's 26 now, and he has found a passion, and I don't know if he can make a living doing that. But as far as finding a job that he can really latch onto and really, you know, feel like he's on his career path, he's really struggling with that. And we've had an episode now where he's kind of turned to alcohol, burned through some money. He's living on his own in an apartment, burned through some money. So now here he is needing money from us, which, you know, we love him. We're going to do it, but we're very frustrated with that. And we just see this cycle. And he is seeing someone now. He didn't want me to be in on the meeting, which, you know, I understand. But so he's real it's pretty hopeful. I'm always hopeful. But it's just this cycle that we can't seem to break.
Very good. I really appreciate the call. It gets me thinking about a lot of things I may not have otherwise mentioned. So, Susan, let's start with just psychiatric diagnosis. You mentioned bipolar, and up until this May, the American Psychiatric Association separated disorders, mental disorders, into at least two big categories. One they called Axis 1, and those were the acute psychiatric disorders like bipolar illness, depression, generalized anxiety. So what a person is diagnosed with on that dimension or axis, like any of the disorders I just mentioned, that doesn't really define their character. In the case of bipolar, if it was an accurate diagnosis, you know, your son has a medical problem. But the diagnosis on that dimension, that acute psychiatric diagnosis, does not explain the lack of a conscience. When you start talking about conscience, you're talking about character. And character is what they called axis too. Again, they've done away with axes, but they're still interesting concepts, dimensions, whatever you want to call them. So there's the acute psychiatric problem like bipolar or the acute episodes. That needs to be treated if it's truly bipolar with medication and therapy. But there's no really great medication for a characterological problem, a chronic behavioral problem. There's no medication. There are good therapies. And when you're searching for a good therapy, it's important that you're working with a therapist that can tolerate somebody that doesn't have a conscience, and that somebody, a therapist that can be both compassionate, empathetic, but also quite firm and direct, because people with these disorders need directness. So therapy is important, but, you know, I seem to every day talk to somebody who says they have an adult child with serious problems like this. Well, it's probably because I do this for a living, but I give the same advice all the time. He's 26 years old. What I would recommend to a mom, and my wife and I have three kids, grown-ups, and so I know firsthand what it's like to raise kids. It is time when they're that old to start thinking of them as friends, not children.
Hmm.
And what would you do with a friend who is 26 years old with bipolar illness and borderline, or I'm sorry, narcissistic personality? You wouldn't have dinner with them every night. You certainly wouldn't pay their bills. If they were getting into trouble and they didn't want your help, you probably wouldn't offer help. If they asked for help, you probably would. So to shift your thinking, Susan, from he's my son to, you know, I'll treat him as a friend. I will give him the support and nurturing and kindness I would a friend. But I'm going to draw a line, like I said earlier to Barbara. I would draw a line, and those would be my boundaries. He wouldn't be allowed to do this and that. So thank you so much for your question.
Today we're talking to Dr. Bruce Leese, professor of family medicine at KU Med Center, and we're talking about narcissism. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard on KCUR. More phone calls, your email, and more conversation with Bruce. That's all coming up on 89.3 FM. Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest is Dr. Bruce Leese. He's a professor of family medicine at KU Med Center. We're talking about narcissism in the home, workplace, politics, and we will be talking about social media here in a few minutes. What's your experience? Email the program, centralstandard@kcur.org, or place a phone call to 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Let's kind of pivot here, Bruce, and let's kind of broaden our scope here and talk a little bit about borderline personality disorder. And first, define that, kind of set that up for us.
Sure, and it's appropriate for us to throw this in now so we don't run out of time, because they're so similar. Both involve patterns of instability, and a person, I'll just contrast it with narcissistic personality first. You know, whereas narcissistic personality disorder involves this pattern of grandiosity, borderline personality involves a pattern of instability in interpersonal relationships, self-image, emotion, impulsivity. So it's almost like the same thing with different symptoms. Borderline, narcissism, both of those two involve a weak sense of self. The narcissist deals with that by trying to be superior. The borderline person does try to get close to people, usually idealizes them, and then it all falls apart when they become possessive. They can get angry easily. They are riddled with anxiety. They tend to think in all and none terms. You know you're with a borderline person where one minute they are happy and they really love you and they're satisfied with the relationship, and all of a sudden they're really irritated and possibly yelling if they're a yeller. And so it's a lot of emotional instability, whereas the narcissist seems to get good control so that they can more control people.
So borderline, we're talking about people who might be having persistent unhealthy thoughts, feelings, and you just alluded to behavior as well.
Absolutely. So they, you know, if I came over to your house and you were on the phone and I had borderline personality and you were talking to your kid in the hospital who had, you know, just been hit by a car, if I were borderline, I'd take it personally that you didn't get right off the phone and talk to me. A lot of idealizing people and then devaluing them when they don't meet your expectations. Again, the undergirding process is this profound sense of, you know, I'm not really worthwhile, so I have to do these dramatic things to regain control in my life.
Luis is joining us from Colombia, and Luis has a relationship with a person who's struggling a little bit. Luis, are you there?
Hi. I've never called in before, so I didn't know if I was on the air. I kind of have a question, but it might take me just a little bit to kind of get to it. I'm kind of wondering about the interplay in relationships between two people, I think the person that I used to be with and I still have a co-parenting relationship with has a borderline personality disorder. And sometimes I feel, you know, I was listening to this program, I'm wondering, and I'm a student of psychology, and I'm always wondering, you know, do I have this or that disorder? And, you know, I'm like, do I have some of these characteristics? Or are these getting reflected back from the person that I was
well,
with?
Well, that's terrific. You know, the problem with being close to somebody unhealthy is that there's a certain contagion that goes with it, a contagiousness, in mm-hmm. that us humans tend to reciprocate what we receive from others. Even some of the nastiest of people will become more kind, we hope, when they're treated kindly. If you are a kind, good-natured person, especially if you're more passive and you're with somebody who is narcissistic or borderline, it will bring out the worst in you. And I think that was your question, and I hope that's the answer.
Did you have a follow-up, Louise?
Well, I do have a follow-up. I'm wondering, are people with personality disorders attracted to one another? I'm just kind of, and this is less about my relationship and more about another relationship. I see it seems like one of them is borderline and one of them's narcissistic, and they almost kind of complete each other, but they egg each other on and they bring out the worst in each other.
Well, you know, that is a question I ask myself every time I work with a couple who's really unhealthy. The answer is yes. Somebody who has a dependent personality, for example, will more likely put up with the antics of somebody who's narcissistic or borderline. Think about a dependent personality. A person with a dependent personality disorder feels very insecure, and they want love, and they want to feel like they're important. Well, along comes the narcissist that tells them how great the narcissist is, and then tells the other person, "And you're great too because you love me." It's a perfect unhealthy fit. So yes, I think people I tend to think that people seek people who are functioning at their own level in
uh-huh.
life, and so
yeah.
The best way to get out of a rut in your life is to avoid seeking somebody who's also in a rut, and to seek people who have strengths that will lift you up rather than knock you down to their level.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting when you come into the relationship at the same level and then one person moves above it and one person doesn't.
Then you can say goodbye.
Yeah.
then you have the strength to say goodbye to the person who is more dysfunctional.
Unless you share a child and then you don't really get to. And that's...
Oddly, having worked with literally hundreds of people who have been divorced, maybe even thousands, in 30 years, I would tell you that I've seen a lot of people become healthier as parents if they were really sick as a married couple. Once they are unhooked and they don't have as much dependency on each other, sometimes they become more healthy in parenting than they were when they were living together, arguing, bickering, screaming, hollering, manipulating, and all that stuff.
You know, let's take that. We're talking about family here. I have a friend whose mother always makes it about her. Now, she can't divorce herself from her mother. I suppose she could. But my friend will initiate a conversation with mom. Mom doesn't hear a word of it and then launches into a monologue that starts with the word I.
Yeah, that's we could go on and on about that situation. It happens all the time. That, you know, that could be caused by a lot of things. Poor social skills, low emotional intelligence, anxiety, or it could be a narcissistic thing, but not necessarily.
Okay. 235-2888 is the phone number, 816-235-2888. And we're joined by Gloria. Gloria is calling from Independence.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a father who's a narcissist, and the issue is that as he ages, it becomes more and more of a problem. He had a stroke about 7 years ago, and because he has this grand and things that would help him. Now he's getting even weaker, and I'm trying to help, but I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Well, hoping you have some hints.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. I will go back to what I said earlier. I used the phrase, I think, emotionally unhook. It is really important to be able, as an adult, to define what part of a problem is yours and what part of the problem is a result of the other person's behaviors or misbehaviors.
Right.
When you've accurately attributed a relationship problem, when you've accurately attributed a relationship problem to, you know, it's 70% him and 30% me, or 30% me and 70% him. Once you define the true responsibilities of both parties, then you can act appropriately. Let's just say that you determine that, you know, there's 22%, Gloria, of you reacting to him that's unhealthy. And what's left? Let's see. 78% is him. You know that you have to change some things about what you're doing. There are times when somebody is really in a bad way. I don't know what aging is doing to this man. If he's really over the top and it's 99%, it's time to attribute that accurately to mostly his problem and pull back and keep a lot of distance emotionally.
Gloria, is he living in your home, and are you his primary care provider?
Well, unfortunately, my sister died, so I'm the only daughter. And he was living with someone who had a borderline personality disorder. That person kicked him out about a month ago. So within 2 days, I had to find him a place. He's at a safe place now. He is at a safe place.
Yeah.
But I just don't feel like he's, you know, attaining his maximum quality of life.
That's your 22.
I hear what you're saying about it's his issue.
But the 22% or whatever it is of your responsibility is when you start assessing where he should be, you know, what percent.
Right.
Regardless of age or gender or relationship, we don't get to determine human being's outcome in any manner, or form. And, you know, I've got family members and friends and patients who I just adore. And the biggest challenge to adults caring for adults is I'll go back to that word boundaries, being able to draw the boundaries and being able to say, he's in a safe place here. That's all I can offer. I'm not going to offer counseling on how he can function more effectively, because that's not my problem, unless you make it your problem.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good luck to you, Gloria, and thanks for phoning
thank
in.
Thank you.
And Mike is joining us. Mike's calling from South Kansas City. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Pardon me. This is somewhat related, but that Castro guy in Cleveland that had the three women in the house, and anyways, they labeled him a sociopath, and I looked that up, and I've always heard it. And knew it was kind of bad or whatever. But my question is, from a professional standpoint, your standpoint, is a person that's, in this case, a sociopath, from a legal standpoint, it seems like they're guilty, but from a your profession standpoint, sociology, whatever, should a person be guilty of, is a sociopath responsible for their actions?
Just to get a little technical on you, if you'll forgive me, sociopath is it's a really helpful concept. I think it was accurate to call Castro a sociopath. If you're interested in personality disorders, the closest personality disorder to sociopath is antisocial personality disorder. However, somebody with an antisocial personality disorder, they will break laws and really misbehave in ways that, you know, that are really kind of visible to the public. They're lawbreakers in a lot of ways. It sounds like Castro was more of a pure sociopath because he hid it so well. He went to church. The community at least as far as we know, that knew him, didn't think he was that off the wall. So, you know, your question is an interesting one. It's kind of the psych diagnosis of this guy Castro, and you know, and whether, I mean, he's a bad guy or a good guy or diagnosable. He was a bad guy who was probably a very severe sociopath. He lacked empathy, and he certainly had no sense of the impact of his behaviors on other humans, just by the way he behaved for whatever it was, 18 minutes in court talking about his view of things.
Yeah, and so from your standpoint, he has control over his what he does, and therefore he or somebody else in his position can be guilty of their...
Oh, yeah. If I were on the jury and not a psychologist, I would be in my right mind to say, put this guy away. He's dangerous. He probably suffered as badly as he started to say he did as a child, but this guy has control over who he is, and he exercised that control in very disturbing ways.
Have a pleasant day, Mike.
Thank you.
And let's talk to C, who's calling us from Lawrence.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Dr. Lee, thank you for this really important topic, and at least in my life right now. I prefer to remain somewhat anonymous because I am currently sharing housing with a woman who has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder with bipolar. And somebody mentioned to me, which turned on a tremendous light in my mind, narcissistic personality disorder. And I'm familiar with it because of previous experiences in my life, and I've been taking too much, I discovered the other day, responsibility in this woman's life. I care about her. I want her to be safe, but I'm not her mother.
Yeah, and there are times when caring about somebody and wanting someone to be safe jeopardizes your own safety.
Exactly.
And it sounds like you may be kind of dependent on this person because you're sharing the living space, probably somewhat financially dependent in that you're sharing rent for a place that you might not be able to afford on your own. If you had the resources to say goodbye, you'd be better off trying to help someone like her not living with her by living in your own domicile far away from her.
Right. And I'm still kind of just, I guess, caught up in that part of my own codependence, okay, or whatever issues I deal with. The truth of the matter is, yes, financially, it's a great help to have her here.
Yeah, I think that results in a lot.
But the major part of the relationship truly is that I love her and care about her, and she's too vulnerable on the streets. And between her mental illness, but this bipolar disorder, what I've had to do is I've set down stronger boundaries, as you suggested. I even sent her to the library the other day. You can walk down to the library and define these kinds of words for me. You know, what is narcissism? What are these other words? You know, what is thievery? What are these things?
Right.
Hoping to spark a response in her that would actually hit her conscience.
Again, you're. Let me stop you here because
we're almost out of time here, Bruce.
You're something I learned back in graduate school many, many, many moons ago is if you're working harder than the person with the emotional problem, you're doing them a disservice. So it sounds like you're working a little too hard to help her, and you'd be served well to turn all that wonderful compassion and helpfulness to others who also need your love, who would benefit even more from it.
So all these disorders are treatable, but the bottom line is, as if I were to have a drug or alcohol problem, I have to admit that there's a problem myself, and I have to ask for help.
Correct. Now, if you have borderline personality, you really are pretty raw and suffer greatly with anxiety, depression, anger, and you're more likely to go for help. If you are narcissistic, admitting that you need help is counter to the very disorder itself, because your predominant thought is, I'm great, I'm terrific, I don't need anything from anyone. So,
are you active on social media?
Not greatly. I have enough contact with all of the major social media sites to know it well, but I'm not active.
Seems like that plays to the narcissism in all of us.
It's really been a fascinating thing to watch the behavior on social media and also watch the research on social media. In fact, the anonymity of social media brings out some of the worst narcissism and borderline personality behaviors that you can imagine. People are very harsh with each other at times, and egotistical and narcissistic. At other times, people are real vulnerable and let their guard down, like as if they had borderline personality, and they shouldn't.
So, well, on Twitter, for example, right now there's a proliferation of physical threats and threats of rape and so forth going on.
That's right.
It's horrible.
Right.
There's been some research done at the University of Michigan. And what they concluded was that there is some connection between narcissism and how often people post on social networks. But they didn't really conclude much beyond that. But they did conclude that it is a handy tool for those who have personality disorders.
Right. It's a predator and prey. It's easy to become a predator on social media or prey to it.
So in the 10 seconds you have remaining, Bruce.
Yes, sir.
Sum this all up for us.
I will sum it all up. If you find yourself feeling upset with people that you have relationships with, take a good hard look at the dynamics between you two. And if the other person has a really severe problem, a personality disorder, for example, back away to find your boundaries and be careful.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Bruce Leese is a psychologist and a professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. Nice to have you back in the studios.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of the previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow for an encore broadcast, and we explain the afterlife of famous corpses with author Bess Lovejoy. Up to Date is next with a look at how high-cost lenders fight to stay legal. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Suzanne Hogan with Sangeeta Shastri and Ross Steinmetz. I'm Bill Anderson. This is KCUR.